Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the very latest episode of the Andy J Podcast. I hope you're having a really good week. Now, my guest today is Spencer Matthews. Here's a man who, when he first came into the public eye, was very much pitted as the pantomime villain. He was in Made in Chelsea from the very start, and he ran on in the show for, I think, 10 seasons. I think it's about 17, 18 seasons deep now. But he was in it for, he was a big, big, big part of the show. If you watched Made in Chelsea in those early seasons, then Spencer was the sort of handsome bad boy, the guy who was a bit naughty with how he treated women and various other things like that. He has completely transformed himself from that persona, and we'll find out in a few moments whether that was real Spencer or whether that was just a person that he was playing for the cameras. But nonetheless, at least in terms of his life as we see it now, he is a completely transformed man. He is married to Vogue Williams. He's a father of two, soon to be three children. He is a businessman, and we talk very candidly about his business now because he really has focused hugely on it, and also his physical fitness. You know, here's a guy that now does jiu-jitsu and extreme marathons like the Marathon de Sable and various others. If you look that up, you'll just realize how punishing and grueling an experience that is. I can tell you that Spencer is extremely good company. Of course, he has podcasts with Jamie and with his wife. He talks to celebrities and so on. So he still has a toe in show business, if you see what I mean, whilst being primarily focused around business life and being a good husband and a good dad. But one thing I will tell you is that I wasn't sure what to expect when talking to Spencer. You know, I sort of went into it. I have seen a bit of Made in Chelsea. I'm not obsessed with it. I don't sort of recall it religiously or anything like that. But of course, like most people, I've been aware of it. And so I was aware of how he came across on screen and things like that. I've also seen him in other TV shows, reality shows like The Jump and MasterChef. There was a sort of well-documented story about how he was in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, but he was sort of ejected very early on for various reasons. We'll talk about all that stuff during our chat. But like I say, I wasn't sure what to expect. Here's a guy who is known, that's the very basics of Made in Chelsea, is these are entitled children. These are kids who have rich parents and who live this elitist lifestyle. So I wasn't sure how he'd be. And I can tell you, he was a really nice guy. There was a moment mid-interview where he sort of said to me, you know, because we're both, I have three children, he's about to become a father to three and so on, and he sort of said, look, we should be mates. And I thought that was just a clever line from him. I thought that was just something he was saying. Because, of course, you know, that often happens. People are very nice to the person that's asking them questions. However, to Spencer's great credit, he has backed it up. He has been in touch with me quite a bit since this conversation. We have even met up at one of his company's events where he treated me to some of his delicious new alcohol-free spirits and a round of crazy golf at a place in central London where I took some friends, and he was extremely nice, very charming. So I can tell you, he's a man of his word, which really, really impressed me. I liked him during our chat. I've liked him even more since our chat. And that is a real test, because there are, I will be straightforward with you, when I have these conversations, there is a sort of natural friendship that forces, you know, you kind of have to be friends with the person you're talking to if you're chatting for as long as I do in many of these conversations. So I feel that a lot of the people that are chatting to me, sometimes they're just being a little bit extra nice, a bit showbiz nice, if you see what I mean. Some of them are lovely after the fact. I sometimes talk about messages, and occasionally I'll meet people for drinks and dinner and so on. And Spencer has been absolutely terrific, a man of his word and a man that I now value very highly. I think he really impressed me in our chat. And as I say, he's impressed me even more afterwards. So that's enough waffle. Sorry to drone on, but he's a good guy. I think you'll enjoy this. Here is, and by the way, I should also let you know there is a delicate subject that we discuss as well concerning the death of his brother. I want to foreflag that with you so that if that is something that will upset you, I would like you to be aware that that is coming up in this conversation. It's something I didn't know much about, and Spencer speaks very openly about being the surviving brother of a tragedy. And I just want to let you know that will be discussed in some detail later in this chat. So please enjoy a very good conversation, thanks to Spencer Matthews.
The Andy J Podcast.
Today's special guest is, I'm going to call him a man transformed. From Made in Chelsea pantomime villain, I guess that's the way to put it, to ultra-marathon running, clean living advocate, parent, husband, and very credible businessman. That said, I still think this chat is going to be a lot of fun. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Spencer Matthews. How are you doing, Spencer?
What an intro. That was wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.
I've actually thought about it, Spencer. I was like, what shall I say? That he was in Made in Chelsea for a while and he was a bit naughty with some ladies, all that kind of thing. But, you know, it was pantomime villain feels like the right way to describe it.
I guess. I mean, you know, a lot of what went on, I suppose, was due to the fact that the show is fueled by drama. So that was essentially the commodity of the show. And yeah, I guess, you know, looking back at it, it was an interesting time in my earlier life, shall we say.
Well, look, you're a long time out of it, so I don't want to sort of spend the next hour discussing Made in Chelsea because, you know, that's a kind of done part of your life. But it is worth kind of marking it. You did the first 10 seasons, which is a, you know, I mean, it kind of set you up as the foundation character. There was you and there was Jamie and there were, you know, two or three others. But in terms of who's been naughty, you know, it was that kind of thing of, well, what's Spencer done now? Who's he gone and had sex with behind someone else's back kind of thing? And it was a sort of recurring theme.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, like anything, I think at the time, the opportunity was interesting and exciting. And, you know, I'd spent a bit of time at theatre school for university. I always wanted to be kind of an actor. So when I was, when I became a city broker, essentially, you know, this opportunity arose at a similar time, and I just thought it would be fun. I never realized that I'd be doing 10 series of it. You know, I'd always wanted to work for myself and do something that I loved, that was meaningful, which I'm sure we'll come on to at some point. But yeah, you know, I it was just a bit of fun. And then, of course, the show can't go on without high levels of drama, and I guess I wasn't expecting to be quite as consumed by it.
Yes, I can imagine that. I mean, Spencer, I've spoken to a few former Made in Chelsea people now, and all of you seem to have a similar kind of objective for going on the show, which is a sort of, it's a bit like when people go into I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here and so on, which I know you did briefly as well, but that's another story. It's effectively using it as a springboard. You know, if I do this, it'll get me a bit of profile, it'll, you know, up my social increase, it'll up my celebrity awareness, and then I can do something serious. But it's a bit of a trap.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's difficult to kind of comment on, I suppose, just because, you know, at the time, I think I was 20 years old. Essentially the appeal of it was different. You know, if the same opportunity presented itself now, I wouldn't find it interesting. You know, So it was, I think people grow, they develop, they change with time. You know, personally, I feel that a lot of the things that were televised could be seen as, you know, relatively normal behavior in your early 20s. Now, I'm not excusing the fact that some of it, you know, wasn't great, but it's certainly not uncommon. I think the difference is that it was televised, and you know, when you look back at it, it's you know, I should say I wish some things weren't documented, but you know, that's life.
It's all part of the fun, though, isn't it, really? I mean, you know, at the end of the day, like you say, you're in your 20s. I mean, I guess the thing that must have been slightly weird is other people's judgment. Because of social media and everything else, you get instant feedback from complete strangers who you'll never meet choosing to comment on your behaviour. Some of them, I imagine, would have been, go on, lad. Another would have been, who the hell do you think you are? What are you doing? But
social media was kind of relatively new then. Instagram wasn't around. I remember Twitter being a new app, you know, then. And actually, it was the most bizarre thing in the world, having people able to just, you know, directly message you essentially for the first time on a public platform. I'm not a huge social media advocate or fan, you know, particularly with young kids. I think it's very useful for marketing, but that's about it for me. I feel that the lack of privacy surrounding social media, and actually I feel, and I'm sure we'll come onto this as well, but I feel that social media has created kind of irreversible trends with younger generations. And it's, you know, I don't mean to sound boring. I see it as being quite dangerous. The lack of privacy is interesting, right? I mean, nowadays you don't need someone's email, you don't need someone's phone number. You can just message them and it'll appear in that person's, you know, pocket, which I personally find, you know, a bit mad. And even if all of the comments and all of the messages are positive, and even if you're very popular and very well regarded, it's still strange that people are able to communicate like that nowadays. So you don't even have the option of turning off the messages. That's what I find. You have the option, obviously, of not being on social media or not using social media. But as I said earlier, you know, there's pros and cons to it. And Twitter was brand new. I remember the first episode of Made in Chelsea. A few of us watched it together who were in the cast when it first came out, and all our phones ping, 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 you know, had notifications on Twitter. Some of the things that people were saying were just, you know, you are kind of opening yourself up, you know, for, you know, well, social annihilation, I suppose, or, you know, love as well, I suppose. But it's just, yeah, it was crazy. I actually remember it.
Yes.
Very, very, very odd thing to be faced with.
Well,
but I suppose you open yourself up to that when you do it. And that's the other thing that people need to understand. You know, like if you want to engage in making television or being visible, you know, in the public eye on any platform or any TV show or whatever it might be, you in my personal opinion, you need to have a bit of a thick skin for it to make sense, because, you know, you can't please everyone.
Yes, and there's a different kind of form of celebrity these days, isn't there? And which has been fueled by social media. I don't mean from reality. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, influencers. They didn't exist. You know, like you say, Twitter was quite new when Made in Chelsea started, but then now there's this new wave of celebrity that are kind of almost replacing reality stars and becoming the new wave of, oh, we're famous for whatever reason it might be now. I mean, there's people famous for cleaning houses and so on.
It's quicker, right? It happens faster. Like back in the day, if you wanted to be on television or you were a successful presenter, you would have to climb a ladder, right? You would have to show talent that was, you know, above and beyond your competitors' talent. And then you may be chosen by a broadcaster, you know, like kind of applying for a normal job, which it is, you know. And that was kind of just the way in which you would achieve your position or your role. And with certain roles would come fame, you know, and there's varying levels of responsibility with that. And also there's, you know, a lot of downside in many cases. Whereas nowadays, I think social media is just so rife that you can make a very unsuccessful show and still become relatively prominent, you know, as such to a certain group of people. You know, that there's no longer the kind of hoops that are necessary to jump through. And I mean, it's just, and even, you know, I'm a big advocate and a big fan of doing things that, you know, feel like they haven't really been done before. And hopefully we'll come on to talk about my business in a bit. But, you know, at the time, Made in Chelsea was really fresh. You know, there was nothing like it on TV.
Yeah.
You know, and it was around the time that The Hills was incredibly successful on MTV in the States. And when I mean successful, I mean, you know, Brody Jenner and Spencer Pratt were wandering around like Brad Pitt and Leo DiCaprio. And I'm not exaggerating. They, you know, I went to university over there and I spent a bit of time with them. And it was just wild, their level of fame. And the money they were making was just ridiculous. You know, like you know, being paid to essentially do nothing. And so, you know, when I went to start my career in inverted commas, with, if you will, in finance, you know, in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, well, why doesn't that exist over here? And wouldn't that be fun to, you know, at this stage in my life, do something similar? And that's kind of why, at the time, it was appealing, I suppose. 10 seasons of it, in my opinion, was too long for me. You know, I shouldn't have stuck around as long as I did. I think my character almost on the show deteriorated over time, in the same way as your work drive might deteriorate in a job that you become bored of.
Yes, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah, the motivation was gone. The caricature had formed. You weren't allowed to kind of have a rebirth.
Yeah, you just feel like you'd been there and done it. You know, it was no longer entertaining or exciting to film. You know, like in the really, well, and that's just for me, and I'm not dissing the show, by the way. You know, great show, God bless, you know, carry on, crack on, no worries. But, you know, unless the cast is you know, enthusiastic and emphatic about what it is that they're delivering and the product that they're making, ultimately, because let's all remember, it's a job, you know, it's going to suffer. So my time had come, basically, to move on. I felt like it was well and truly milked.
Yes. Yeah, and milk it you did. So, I mean, good for you, man. You know, you made the most of it. It set you up. It got you to where you are. And everything's a stepping stone, isn't it? Everything takes us to the next step and where we go from there. So more power to you. You know, you must have had very thick skin, though, because there were times when I imagine you were getting a lot of heat. And
yeah, absolutely. You'd be amazed how hard it is to move on from that. Not the persona. You know, I feel like the persona is dead and buried, you know, married now, third kid on the way, sober. You know, life is pretty different to some of those scenes that some people may remember in the show. So, you know, and I think that's relatively apparent. But it's, yeah, I mean, you know, you can't really shake it. Like, you'll always be, this is actually pretty rare to be talking about. We have an hour, so obviously it's nice to have a great catch up with you and discuss it, but not something I talk about very often. You know, like I typically, if I'm giving an interview, I wouldn't mention it. In fact, I probably avoid it. You know, I do what I can now to be seen, you know, in the way that I am, which doesn't include, you know, any of this reality TV stuff, really. And it's just interesting because it just doesn't matter, you know, how long you're someone else, essentially. Like, I'll always be that guy from Made in Chelsea.
Yes. Yes. Well, I think that's the thing. In the public eye, you tend to be forevermore, even if it's just a distant memory, the person they saw first. So whatever it is, you know, great actors will always be remembered for the very first movie that they were a massive star in. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio, you think of him because you cited him. You know what I mean? There's just multiple things. You think of him as Romeo and all the rest of it. It's just always there. It doesn't mean he's not brilliant in the next film and we don't see him as something else, but it's always around, isn't it? So there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a body of work.
Unfortunately.
It's just a first line in a CV, Spencer. You know, that's the way I'd think about it. You know, and your CV is
at
massive.
At the bottom, in small font.
Yeah. Yeah, read the small print or try and avoid it if you can. Well, I mean, Spencer, I was more interested in your, before we get on to, because I'm really keen to learn about Clean Co and the incredible things you're doing with it and the man you are now, frankly, because some of the things that I've been reading about you, I've been doing some swatting up on you, obviously, because we've got this hour together. And I can only be sort of humbled and impressed learning about some of your achievements and thinking, holy moly, this guy really has gone for it in a massive way. And so I'm extremely keen to explore the you before Made in Chelsea and the you after. I'm not really fussed about the reality stuff. And the thing that I'd like to talk about, obviously, because of the whole Made in Chelsea thing, everybody knows that there's been wealth in your family. You know, you're from a wealthy background. You've had a sort of decent kickstart financially in life, at least. But what did that mean in reality for you? And I mean this in the most sort of gentle of terms. So please excuse me if this is a bit of a weird question. But
I think it's very important. But go on if you had a specific question.
Well, it's something like, I don't really know how to phrase it, but I'll try anyway. You know, when people see rich families, they sort of consider them to be formal and perhaps distant. You know, so you don't sort of imagine little you getting wrapped in hugs from mummy and daddy and telling fart jokes around the sofa and so on. But was that the norm?
I had a great childhood, and I'm very fortunate to be incredibly close with both parents who are still together. And you know, I think that's a really wonderful thing. You know, very close with my brother and you know everyone else in my family pretty much. And I feel you know, and just to clarify, the wealth came in our family anyway from my dad. So we're not from a wealthy family essentially prior to him. You know, I've had a great upbringing, but his father was a coal miner, and his mother, you know, lived in Rotherham, and you know, he came from a very humble start in life, and you know, was I think I'm all right to say was kind of the only successful sibling, even, you know, who was able to you know, work his, you know, work as hard as he did for as long as he did, and he still does, by the way, to you know, generate what you have called, you know, wealth, to have us recognized as a wealthy family. So it hasn't just been, you know, passed down, and you know, I do see a difference there. You know, my dad has only ever taught me to you know, try and be happy but work hard. You know, nothing comes easy in life, and dad of course has helped me from time to time, as any parent would want to help their kids.
Yeah,
you know, it's nothing really like, I will do what I can for my kids. Hopefully I'm not going to spoil them rotten. You know, I need them to understand how to get places in life. You know, I want them to live full lives. I want them to struggle a bit. And, you know, I'm not here on air, you know, pretending that I've had a hard life, but there's certainly been times when I haven't had it as easy as people would probably think, right? So, and that's from, in my opinion, good parenting. And you know, I have work ethic instilled in me that has always been there, you know, like everyone in my family has. And I suppose we are all successful now in our own right. And you know, it's not, we have always, you know, looked at things in a very specific way. I mean, you know, my dad is Yorkshire, he's Northern. You know, if I wanted something desperately, you know, growing up, or if I just wanted money for whatever reason, you better believe it wasn't just kind of dropped in my back pocket. You know, of course, you know, I might go to mum, for example. You know, I've had a nice life, but you know, it was you know, hard work and being honest as being kind of at the forefront of that. You know, well, at least lessons from my parents. So, you know, I think we all get along famously, and we're very lucky for that.
Yes, and with your dad being Northern as well, it sounds, because I have Northern roots myself, and you know, two words that sort of strike me as being what epitomizes the Northern work ethic is true grit.
Yeah. No, you know, he was a car mechanic who became a racing driver, and then invested in, you know, a number of things which happened to do okay, and then he bought a really rundown piece of property over in the French West Indies. We relocated there when I was a little kid. You know, the place was covered in cockroaches and rats and whatever else. And he kind of almost, well, not quite single-handedly now, him and mum turned that place into, you know, one of the greatest, you know, hotel destinations in the world. But yeah, they did that.
Yeah.
You know, they work hard. They don't give up. They push themselves through tough times and come out, you know, hopefully on top. You know, we're a very competitive family. And, you know, when we come to talk about CleanCo, for me, in my, you know, with the business which I founded in 2019, giving up's not an option. Have there been hard times to get it to where it is? Yeah. You know, have things gone badly at times? Of course they have. Like, none of this is smooth and easy. Any entrepreneur, you know, will tell you that to get firing on all cylinders and get up and running and fully funded and, you know, doing the kind of rate of sale, if you're an FMCG or selling physical goods, you know, that you, you know, need, you know, or sticking to plan, is really hard. You know, it takes an awful lot of work. And you know, I guess I love it as well. I have the good fortune to absolutely love what I do, which makes working hard easier.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I mean, you've given us a snapshot there of the childhood that you had, Spencer. Of course, you're kind of talking about St. Bart's, where you spent a lot of your formative years, and it's on record to know that you went to Eton as well, and you know, you've had that in your history. But one of the things that I've only heard you talk about very fleetingly, and that might be from choice, in which case, you know, we won't open the door for too long, but for me, it seems to be something that must have shaped you and probably added to your incredible resilience, which is something I think that you've demonstrated in droves, was the tragedy that hit when you were 10 years old, which was the death of your big brother.
Yeah.
Are you okay talking about that?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I love talking about Mike, and, you know, I'm kind of desperate in some way for him to, you know, be remembered and recognized for his bravery and, you know, what he was able to instill kind of in me is something I'd love to share with people. You know, he was amazing. He, you know, I didn't know him as well as I would have liked, of course, because I was 10, right? So, you know, he was 22 at the time of his death. He was the youngest Brit to reach the summit of Mount Everest. There were several complications on the mountain, unfortunately, which probably could have been avoided, and we lost him. He died on the way down from Mount Everest. But he yeah, as I said, he was the youngest Brit to reach the summit, and you know, we still remember him very fondly. I credit certain elements of you know, successful times in my life to being guided by him. At times, you know, sometimes very what appear to be extraordinary things happen, you know, in my life that could be mistaken for luck. And I like to think that it's him. You know, he's very relevant to me. You know, he's I saw a photo of him today. You know, we have a picture of him here with us on, even though we're abroad. You know, he's incredibly important to me. So it was a tricky pill to swallow because I didn't really understand it at the time. You know, I didn't believe that he had died. I could see that my family were, you know, inconsolable, completely distraught. But I always had an image of him coming back. You know, I didn't buy it, you know, as a kid. So it probably didn't hit me as hard as it could have done if I was older. So it was just an interesting time. And obviously, the longer the time that passed, the more, you know, clear and evident it was that we were never going to see him again. And, you know, his body remains on Mount Everest somewhere near the summit. And you know, we think about him all the time.
Yes. Do you think, again, I'm not a psychologist, so I have no idea how these things work, Spencer, but I've lost people close to me, and I'm acutely aware that it's changed my destiny and changed who I am as a person, and it stays with you forever. But do you think Michael's death sort of immediately and instantly changed the trajectory of who you were?
It's hard to say. I think if I was talking to a therapist, one would think that was entirely possible. But obviously it's a difficult thing to call. When you look back at you know life and you wonder why things are a certain way, and you know, you try and explain it, or you try and pin it on the loss of a loved one or whatever else it may be, I suppose there's no real way of knowing if that was the event that led to whatever change that might have been. So, you know, it's an interesting one. And it's something I like to talk about, actually. I find psychology really interesting.
Well, I've been wondering, because you've done a number of, particularly recently, the last 2-3 years, you've done a number of quite extreme physical things. You know, if you don't mind me saying, you're a blue belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. You've done which is a ridiculous sentence, but phenomenal. I mean, more power to you for that, man. You've done these celebrity boxing bouts. You've put yourself through the Marathon de Sable, which is, as far as I know, it's pretty much the most extreme marathon on the world, isn't it? Like 6 marathons in 5 days across the Sahara Desert, which is, just thinking about it, sounds horrific, but to do it must be incredible. So I'm wondering how much Michael is with you, because of course the last thing he did in his life was the pinnacle of physical achievement. You know, it was something that, you know, a 10-year-old looking at that would have been heroic. Yeah. So I'm wondering if some of these things that you do to yourself physically now are to match that achievement or to make him proud.
Yeah, well, I certainly see it that way. You know, I wouldn't, again, typically say it, but you know, we have a foundation in Mike's name in Africa. We look after just over 4,000 kids at the moment. I say we being kind of direct family members, and we provide kind of education for young girls who would be unlikely to receive an education at all, and we build schools in remote parts of Africa to eliminate incredibly long journeys on foot, daily long journeys, and therefore eliminate the risk associated with young girls walking those kind of distances on their own in Africa. So his name lives within the foundation. And whenever we do, I say we, this is my brother and I, do you know, the Marathon de Sable or you know, Ironman or whatever it might be, we raise money for the Michael Matthews Foundation. So, so that children can enjoy an education in Mike's name.
Good for you.
So that's a kind of reason. But yeah, I agree. I mean, Mike was certainly present with me on day four of the Marathon de Sable. I'll tell you that. It's an 82.5-kilometer stint, single stint. It was 59 degrees that day. It's the hottest Marathon de Sable on record. They did it on October 11th. It started last year because they'd missed it for 2 years due to COVID. So it was at a very, very hot time. It was the first death on record for many years. A French gentleman died. A few people in comas. You know, it was a you know, sketchy race at times. You know, very long, very arduous. Plenty of kind of mental resilience required. And you know, it was just you know, so there were times in that I actually found myself talking to myself, or talking to Mike, essentially. You know, to try and power through some of the harder bits of that long day, which took me 14 hours and 44 minutes. And it was. Yeah, you know, I think it's nice, isn't it, to have, you know, a feeling that somebody's there helping you, you know, regardless of whether, you know, you believe it or not. I think it's nice to, you know, I'm not a particularly religious person, as an example. So this, I suppose, is if we're getting deep, is like my religion. You know, yeah, I would pray to God.
It's
spiritual. I would pray to God. I would pray to Mike. Yeah.
Yeah, you're being spiritual. You're not being religious, but you believe that he's out there, and why not? You know, prove that he's not. You can't.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So yeah. Well, to answer your question, you know, he I'd like to think he lives a bit in me. I'd like to think he lives in the people that I love. You know, and helps us in times of trouble.
Yes. Yes, and I imagine you'll start to see him in your kids as well as they grow and get older.
I certainly hope so. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, he was a very impressive character, obviously, to us, you know, his family. But he was only 22, right? So this image that I've created, essentially, of Mike, who could do anything and you know, nothing's too hard. And, you know, that I try and live by as well a little bit is helpful. Even though, you know, it could even have been unrealistic.
Hello, it's John Markar here from our sister podcast, The Driven Chat Podcast. Right now, you're listening to The Andy J Podcast, and it's quite good, isn't it? In fact, do me a favour, give it a little review, 5 stars, and wherever you're listening, hit that little subscribe or follow button, because it does help. See you around.
The Andy J Podcast.
Yes, but it's the impression you have, and that's all that matters.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, they are the people they were to us, and that's great, you know. And that's I'm all for that. Yeah, no, that's really powerful. I mean, just like that, Spencer. You know, we've gone from, you know, I imagine from a listener's perspective, because certainly as the guy talking to you, you know, listening to your reality stuff, and then hearing about the actual reality of your life, these are two very different people. You know, you are a very real, rounded, impressive human being away from kind of the nonsense of reality star noise. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's very kind of you. You know, I certainly hope to think so. You know, as I said earlier, I wish I hadn't done quite as much reality. I wish I hadn't been quite as public as I was. But, you know, I guess these things happen for a reason, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's you could even say, well, that's what led you to meet your wife or whatever. You know, you can find reasons.
Yeah, no, well, absolutely. Well, that absolutely is the case. You know, there's no way that I would have done the jump, I suppose, without having done Made in Chelsea, and that's where I met my wife. So that's a good way of looking at it.
There you go. And that justifies the means, right? So boom, sorted.
Yeah, there you go, done.
Yeah. We could just, and from now on, maybe if anyone brings it up, you say you don't talk about it often, and I imagine it won't be revisited for many more chats, but if it does ever come up, you can just throw it away like that. Well, yeah, I did it because it made me meet my wife. End of story. Yeah. You know, move on.
There you go.
Yeah.
Door shut.
Sorted. Slam. I mean, look, I've got a suggestion for you for another extreme event, but I'm going to come on to that later because I'm very keen to get onto Clean Co, because this is something that I think is, it's such an important part of your life, but it's also going to change a lot of lives. Not in kind of humanitarian ways, but I think it's going to do a lot of good. It's going to be really interesting to provide people with an alternative form of pleasure, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So do you want to,
well, hopefully, yeah.
Do you want to talk us through it? And I will come back to this extreme idea, because it does sound like you love putting your body through challenges. So I've got one for you later.
I find it a really good balancing act to have these kind of, you know, audacious goals, whether or not they be physical or, you know, in business or just in life in general. You know, I would far rather miss a really audacious goal, you know, than achieve an easy one.
Yeah.
So, you know, in my eyes, I like to set myself things, you know, to do or to try and achieve that, you know, even in my eyes seem, you know, not particularly achievable. And you know, that's fun for me. It's just the way I am. You know, I really, if I do something, I want to make it, you know, a really big deal. You know, otherwise I just don't really see the point.
You've certainly set the standard here, Spencer. You know, what sounds hard? Oh, I know, 2 marathons in 2 days. Nah, 5 marathons in 6 days in the desert. That sounds hard. I'll do that.
6 and 5, my friend.
Six and five. There you go. Yeah, yeah. My bad. My maths has never been my thing. Yeah. Also, I have 3 kids, so I now have the excuse. You talk to me in like six months' time.
We have a lot in common, by the way.
Do we?
I'm realizing on this call alone that we have a lot in common.
Okay.
I'm about to have 3 kids. You don't drink alcohol.
Yeah.
Well, you've lost people that are very close to you. You seem to have quite similar views to me on what we're talking about. I feel like we should be friends after this.
I'm up for that. Let's do it. That sounds good.
Excellent.
Although, you know, I have a 10-month-old as my third, so I'm in that shattered phrase where my brain is so foggy.
Yeah, 3 years.
Yeah. No, I'm here to help with any advice you need on having 3. It does involve get as much sleep as you can now because it's about to disappear. Yeah.
Excellent. That's fab. You know, you hear all about that. We're delighted. You know, we're, as I said, you know, both my wife and I love kids and feel very fortunate to have such a strong relationship. And, you know, very, very thankful for that. And yeah, we love our kids. You know, we'd say another. Why not?
Yeah, it's great. Will you be stopping at 3?
I mean, we always used to say that we wanted 4, but you know, it's not. I think at 3 we'd be very happy.
Yeah.
And you know, we'll have to see. I mean, I don't put myself through the mainly because it's impossible. But I you know, we've got the easy end of the stick, I think, when it comes to the pregnancies themselves.
Which so is not our fault, Spencer. That's not our fault. This is a conversation I imagine you have to have regularly. If I could change it, I would.
Exactly.
I literally
can't. If I could, I would. So, yeah. But unfortunately, I can't. So yeah, no. So I'm very happy to be led by Vogue. We're lucky enough to have 1 child, let alone a third on the way. So you know, we're all very happy about that. But yeah, you mentioned clean, did you?
Yes, of course, of course. Yeah, I mean, you have been very patient to hang fire for like half an hour before we bring up your other baby, which is this wonderful business that you've launched, and to some significant fanfare as well, by the way. It's not like it's just kind of mulling away as this kind of niche thing that no one can get hold of and it's hardly available and you've got to go to this alternative website on the dark web with a weird password and all the rest of it. It's everywhere, and it's, I mean, by the sound of things, it's about to be everywhere worldwide as well. Tell us all about it, Spencer. In your words, it's much better coming from you.
Well, thanks, mate. And yeah, I think, you know, you were kind enough to say that it's been very well received, and I think that's due to kind of the authenticity of, you know, what it meant to me around the time of launch. You know, it's, I think when choosing something that you know you're going to be involved in for many years to come, and you know, you're going to put your life into it to make it a success, you need to make sure that you love what you're doing. You know, like absolutely, you know, some people are kind enough, I suppose, to ask for some advice on starting businesses from time to time. And like, honestly, don't do it if you don't love it. Because it has to be something you really care about, because it's tough. It's, you know, there's peaks and troughs, and you know, it certainly isn't all rosy. But having said that, I was sober for about 4 months at the time, and just noticed that there was this glaring kind of gap when compromising on what I was drinking, you know. So I went from drinking pretty regularly, right? I would drink when I was a city trader, you know, daily, you know, all the time. I would entertain, I would drink at lunch, and then I would drink with clients in the evening. And, you know, if you didn't drink, it would have been incredibly odd in
it's,
the job
it's,
that
it's
I had.
Part of the gig. Yeah, it's just part of the gig.
Yeah. Totally part of the gig. Like I was saying just today to somebody over here, because they were asking me about this, and I was saying, honestly, I think if I had declared that I was alcohol-free back then, I would have probably lost my job. Mm. You know, because all just the entertainment came with it. Anyway, so I noticed that, you know, alcohol-free beer has been around for about 22 years, but has only been put on the map properly recently. And that, in my opinion, is because the gap between desire and compromise is so slight that now when you choose between an alcoholic beer or a non-alcoholic beer, the similarity is such that the experience is the same.
Okay.
Right? That's kind of my view on it. Unless, of course, you're drinking to get drunk or you want to get tipsy or whatever, in which case, obviously, drink the alcoholic beer. You know, nobody's got any issues with that. But if you're just looking for a beer because it's a nice hot day and, you know, you want to put your feet up and have a beer, but, you know, you've got stuff on or you have kids or for whatever reason, you know, you don't want the high level of alcohol.
Yeah, or you're driving.
An alcohol-free beer. Yeah, an alcohol-free beer is going to fill the void, right? So another very quick example is it's easier now to be vegan, in my opinion, than ever before, right? So if you want a cheeseburger, right, but you're deciding to go meat-free back in the day, yeah, rewind the clock 5 years, you're looking at, or, you know, call it 10 years for the sake of argument, you're looking at a nut roast as a substitute to your cheeseburger that you want, which is a big compromise, right?
Yes.
Then there's corn, you know, less of a compromise, but still a compromise. Then there's a veggie burger, compromise. Then there's kind of Impossible Meat and Beyond Burger. All of a sudden, there's not so much compromise, right? It's kind of easy to have a meat-free cheeseburger and for the experience to be quite similar. And that didn't exist in alcohol. So there wasn't a way of me enjoying a gin and tonic or a mojito or a rum and coke without the alcohol. And I just kind of got thinking, why is it that alcohol-free beer, you know, has lifted off? And, you know, Heineken spent $30 million in a single year once the product was good enough, you know, to really fill the demand for the consumer. Then the consumer, you know, loved it so much, it's now one of Heineken's biggest products, you know. And it turns out that the alcohol level was almost kind of irrelevant to some people at some stage, right?
Yeah.
So my mind kind of went into a bit of a flow. It didn't really exist. Seedlip was around. It was the only brand in the world that existed. And you know, I hopefully people think that I speak well of Seedlip. I always, you know, I think Seedlip is the most amazing brand, but it's quite a complicated, you know, proposition. It purposefully doesn't play in the gin space. In fact, you know, it says we are not a gin. And therefore the kind of, it's a complicated thing to understand what it is. What's it going to taste like? How do I mix it? You know, like, am I going to take this jump into non-alc not knowing what the product's going to taste like? So anyway, long story short, I wanted to create clean drinking. I wanted to get rid of the negative bar call, you know, like non-alcoholic, alcohol-free. I wanted to get rid of that and make it more kind of socially acceptable to order a non-alcoholic drink, you know, using, you know, clean drinking, you know, like clean living. And Clinco was born, and we aim to make alcoholic replacements, essentially replacements, alternatives to full strength alcoholic spirits. We do a gin, a pink gin, a rhubarb gin, a rum, a vodka. We've got a tequila, and we've got a whiskey coming out. And it's basically so that people can feel included when they're making the positive decision to drink less.
So, I think, you know, this is great.
Like, so, sorry to kind of ramble on, but it's kind of like, if I was not drinking, I went into a pub and I ordered, you know, 3 gin and tonics for my mates and a Diet Coke. Your Diet Coke makes you not fit in. It's hard to feel included. It's hard to feel a part of the group. It's one of the reasons that people give up in Dry January. You know, the temptation is such that, you know, or they just don't want to feel left out.
Oh, but also, Spencer, it's so boring. I don't mean Diet Coke as a drink or whatever. I'm not knocking any other flavors.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're there on a session, as it were, you know, you're joining your mates who are out on it and 10 pints in, and you're still having the same drink with none of the sort of benefits of being drunk or whatever. I mean, I used to say, because I've been sober for 3+ years now, and I used to say, when people are like, oh, and yeah, what do you want, mate? I'd just be like, whatever, just something without alcohol. Yeah. I literally don't care. You're going to get me lemonade or orange juice or Coke, and it's whatever. You know, it's just, it's basically just something that's going to get me going to the toilet. There's no fun around that. It just, you know, it's not an event. You know, you go to the pub for an event, exactly, you're hanging out, having a good time. And it's, you know,
there's no ritual to it. There's no familiarity with it. You know, like when you are, you know, mixing yourself a cocktail at home, that comes with slicing up a lemon, you know, and it comes with, you know, ice clinking around your glass. It's an event.
That's a whole process. You may not think
it's a meaningful event, but it's an event. You're registering that as it's gin and tonic time. It's an event.
Oh, it can be a performance as well, Spenny. If you've got, sorry, I just called you Spenny there. My apologies.
No, I loved it.
Well, we are becoming friends, but it's one of those things where, you know, you've got a few friends round and you're going to do a G&T or whatever. You're going to be a bit of a showman. You get your chopping board out. You use the best knife and so on.
I had some people around for lunch the other day, and one of them doesn't drink alcohol, and I rustled up some clean Palomas using our clean tequila. And you know, it like everybody else was drinking, you know, gin and tonics, bit of wine, and we were there with our, you know, fresh grapefruit juice and clean tequila, and we fit in. You know, we're having a fun afternoon. So it's the inclusivity. It's the not having to compromise. You know, I think, and again, not to be boring, you know, we had Dry January last month. You know, it's only hard if you have to make compromise, and it's only hard if you have to change habits which you've had, you know, or developed over time. You know, if you are used to drinking every single Friday night, then not drinking on a Friday night sends you off, right? It feels weird.
Yeah.
But if you're able to drink, to just replace your gin and tonic or two with a clean gin and tonic or two, and it smells the same, and it looks the same, and it tastes the same, and it's then there's an opportunity there, you know, to allow people to moderate or not drink at all, but without compromising on social experience, which is something that people are fascinated with. You know, fear of missing out is really real. You know, people feel that if they're not going to drink alcohol, then they're not going to have fun. And that's nonsense.
Yeah,
that you know, nonsense. Like that is just nonsense. But for people who think it's not nonsense, you can have that same experience of drinking your favorite cocktail with a clean cold alternative. And by the way, I should probably mention, given that we're on the radio, there are, you know, hundreds of other businesses that do similar stuff to us now, that didn't exist before. But, you know, if you're not a clean co fan, or you're not a fan of, or you're not, you know, a fan of mine, if you pop into Sainsbury's, you know, or Tesco's or Morrison's, you know, they have whole aisles now of alcohol free, you know, alternative spirits and beers and wines and whatever else there is. You know, it's a really interesting time.
You're really loving this, by the sound of things.
I just think it was great that my idea at the time was so validated, right? We were able to raise significant funds quite quickly and move straight to Series A and Series B, you know, and grow the business in a really meaningful way, which means, you know, venture capitalists and entrepreneurs and investors alike share the vision, and that's a nice thing. Anyway, you know, sometimes you can have what you feel is a great idea and you pitch it to people and they go, no, man, I don't get it. Or, you know, what's the point in that? And so for it to be validated and you know, to have gone as well as it has so quickly is obviously personally great. You know, I've loved building the business, and We've been focused mainly on a US expansion. We're in 7 states in the US, and by the end of this year, we aim to be in 36 states. And you know, there's an even more exciting market because they're essentially 18 months to 2 years behind us in this space. So there, it really feels like we're kind of trailblazing. Yes. You know, even though we were trailblazing in the UK as well, you know, it's all of a sudden you could almost call it saturated, the market, which is insane to me because we were alone, you know, 2 years ago. And now we're most certainly not. But you know,
it's very on trend. You know, there was a period where everyone was bringing out a gin, not a non-alcoholic gin, but just a gin.
Yeah. You know,
there was another new gin coming out every week or so. Now it feels like this is, and yes, you're ahead of the curve, and it sounds like you've set the trend. The one I'm particularly keen to know about, Spencer, because obviously you said sort of rum, tequila, vodka, gin, and so on, and they all seem to me in terms of tastes, they all seem to me as being, yeah, they would be difficult to nail it, to get it exactly right, but achievable. Yeah. The one you've said that's coming out, that I'm like, how are you going to nail that? Is whiskey. I mean, that sounds really tough.
We've been developing it for nearly a year. It's really hard. Also, you know, people who drink whiskey, right, they like alcohol, right? You won't find people who drink a little bit who tuck into whiskeys regularly. So it's almost like we're going to have a tougher crowd. And a more skeptical crowd.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting one. Like take vodka as an example. You remove the ethanol from vodka, you've got water. So how do you make a non-alcoholic vodka? Well, we did it flavored. You know, we did a spiced apple vodka.
Okay.
You can't hide behind the flavor with whiskey or gin or any of the others for that matter, because you have to make it as similar to the real thing as possible. And by the way, if you're listening to this thinking, oh, I've never heard of alcohol-free spirits, I'm going to give this a try, and you have a shot of the clean tequila neat, there's a chance you might be disappointed, right? There's no alcohol in these liquids. So you know, these are very much designed for cocktail making, for showmanship, as you called it. You know, this is an event. This is, you want to mix yourself a gin and tonic, you want to mix yourself a margarita, you want to mix yourself a mojito. You know, you'll probably laugh at this, although, you know, we see ourselves as almost like a tech company that creates products.
Yeah, that makes sense.
In the same way that I wouldn't expect you to have an iPhone 6 or 7, you know, a lot of people who use iPhones get the latest iPhone, you know, whenever it comes out. And that's, they don't even need it, but they do it because technology is moving in such a way that people want the latest and the best. And it's similar with us. You know, if we sit on a recipe for too long, somebody else will come along and do it better. Technology is changing very quickly. These trends are you know, almost uncontrollable. There's millions of people who are interested in this space. And unless you're kind of cutting edge and looking for ways to make it better to the point where you and I could enjoy a straight glass of clean whiskey and for it to be the same as, you know, a scotch, we're a little while away from it, right? Everyone is.
Oh yeah.
You know, Diageo haven't done it. Pernod haven't done it. You know, we are working on it. But that's what, you know, RMPD, new product development is, you know, we know what we're doing for the next 2 years, you know, and it's all ordered and it's, you know, it's all, you know, part of the forecast. We know exactly what we're doing and when, and that involves, you know, recreating and amplifying even our best selling liquids. You know, we can't be asleep at the wheel.
No, you have to keep evolving.
All.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, Spencer, if you can replicate Lagavulin, I would be extremely grateful.
Okay. We'll see what we can do. Pop round to the clean kitchen. we put up a shack in the CleanCo office car park so that these two incredible women, both called Lucy, actually can work away on flavor development from literally the car park of our office. So
brilliant.
Pop over one day when all three of your kids are asleep and we'll show you how kind of at least ideas get started.
That would be amazing, because those are one of the two things I crave or I miss. You know, now I haven't had a drink for such a long time. I used to love Guinness, and I know there's an alternative, but it's not. For me, it hasn't quite nailed it. And I mean that respectfully to Guinness. I'm sure they've been selling in, you know, by the barrel, but
sorry to interrupt you. I was in Hoth recently, which is where my wife is from, and popped into the pub just to order a bit of lunch to take down the road, and I noticed that they had Guinness Zero on tap, which never used to be there, of course.
Yeah,
and it was never used to be there, of course. And I said, you know, how is the Guinness Zero selling? And this is, you know, in Ireland, like the English, you know, the Irish love a drink. And I too don't mean that in a disrespectful way, but, you know, pub culture is pretty rife in both countries. And honestly, the barman looked at me and he just said, like, mate, it sells out. You know, we cannot have enough of it.
Mm.
It's just people are on it the whole time because we're changing the barrel, you know, almost daily.
Wow.
You know, and this is in pretty kind of still kind of COVID times. I mean, obviously it's still COVID times, but I mean, you know, there's still social distancing and you know, I wouldn't say the pub was overflowing with people yet. They're still getting through barrels of Guinness Zero. So my point is, it's, you know, this kind of stuff, the social experience is the same. I mean, strangely enough, I haven't had a Guinness Zero and I'd love to try it, but you know, I can imagine that the experience of having the barman pouring the Guinness Zero out of a tap and you sitting, you know, in the pub with your mate drinking a Guinness Zero is going to feel exactly the same as drinking a Guinness.
Yes, that would be completely different to the one I took out of the fridge. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but, you know, that's essentially what we're trying to do. You know, it's very rare. In fact, I'd go so far as to say I suspect no one has ever woken up and said, "I wish I drank more alcohol last night." You know, so. I think even if you're, you know, a drinker who has no interest in non-alcoholic drinks, perhaps you have an interest in staying out for longer, you know, and staying in the fun for longer, right? Nobody likes taking it too far. You know, I'm sure that people listening can all, if you drink alcohol, think of a time where you've had a bit too much, you know, the room's spinning a bit maybe, you know, whatever it might be. You know, wouldn't it be nice to intersperse, you know, clean drinks when you feel like you've had too much alcohol, so
yeah.
You can carry on, you know, the fun. You don't have to go home. You know, oh, I'm feeling a bit tipsy. You know, I need to leave. You know, I might embarrass myself. No,
yeah. Well,
five more clean gin and tonics, mate.
Well, exactly. There are plenty of people that will go, you know, they'll have a couple of pints and then they'll have a lemonade or a water or whatever to try and, you know, kind of pace themselves. And now they've got an alternative that doesn't look, what's the term? Cheating is wrong. You know what I mean? But it looks like they're still kind of having a proper night out rather than they've, you know, deferred to a pint of water, which is often, you know, just...
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's great. I mean, this is going to be massive, Spencer. I mean, you've obviously, as you've mentioned, you're already in a load of supermarkets and that must be transformative for the business because that would have given you the confidence to just kind of keep on evolving and immersing yourself in it and going for it because suddenly... It's been taken seriously by the big boys straight away, hasn't it?
Yeah, and absolutely. We always saw the at-home opportunity as being more prominent than the on-premise activity to begin with. This was before COVID. You know, our initial business plans obviously didn't account for a global pandemic that we didn't know was around the corner. So, you know, we always thought, you know, where are people most likely to enjoy, you know, a clean gin and tonic? And the answer we quickly found would be at home. So retail and direct to consumer were always going to be our core focus. And now, you know, thankfully we have, you know, hundreds of people saying, oh, you know, it'd be so great if they served it in bars. And we're working on that now, given the, you know, law and legislation around, you know, what bars and on-premise are allowed to do now with COVID seem to be softening a little bit. So I hope very much that you'll see us in your local in no time.
Yeah, sounds likely. And you've become Mr. Clean.
Yeah, I guess. Well, you know, I think it was about time.
Well, fair enough. Oh, mate, this is, I mean, I said at the start, a man transformed. That's how I called you. And it really is. There's a kind of, this is a complete about face. And it's lovely to witness, actually. Now, I told you that I had an extreme physical challenge for you that I think you should attempt because now you're into this and you sound to me like the kind of guy that actually likes a challenge, likes to be challenged and to be set challenges, you know, kind of jump over this hoop. All right, I'm not going to jump over that one. I'm going to jump over the one above it. Now, just looking at the other shows you've done in terms of, you know, the kind of TV scene, The Jump, obviously, where you met Vogue, your now wife, and you won that one. Credit to you, because that is extreme. I mean, that's going up against Olympians and you know, doing all the kind of skiing and jumping and all the rest of it. It can be brutal. It kind of takes people out. Rebecca Adlington, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago, she dislocated her shoulder and couldn't complete it. So injuries happen a lot on that show. So you did really well with that. You've obviously had your boxing. You've been MasterChef a couple of times and nearly won it, I think.
Yeah, for both times, Anyway, I think the first loss was well deserved. John Partridge beat me absolutely fair and square. I mean, that guy is a sensational chef. I think he's actually even become a chef, as well as, you know, lots of the other exciting and interesting things that he does. But he's the kind of guy that can walk into a kitchen and rustle up a cake with no recipe.
Oh.
You know, like he knows what he's doing big time. He can walk in and, you know, just make soda bread from scratch just because he makes it all the time at home. You know, he's a proper chef.
Good for him. So then you go back, you don't win it again. Does that mean you're going to have to go back a third time to win it? Is that an unscratched itch?
I'll tell you what, if I can find the time to do MasterChef again, that there is unfinished business in that kitchen.
It has to happen. And then you did that thing with Jamie. Was it like the chase or something where they're hunting you down? That looked fun.
Hunted. That was great fun. Yeah. Now, Jamie and I are fortunate to work together on a podcast called 6 Degrees. And we, you know, we love each other very much. That's a relationship that's only got stronger with time. You know, I absolutely love that bloke. He's fantastic. And no, doing that show in particular was great fun. I mean, that's really real, by the way. You know, some of this reality TV stuff, dare I say it, isn't as real as some people might think.
No, come on. Don't say nonsense like that, Spencer. I've been with you all the way, but to suggest it's not real, come on now.
I'm only joking. But Hunted was fantastic. They literally, they just dump you in the middle in our case, a town square in London. And I think they give you an hour's head start and they just say, go.
Yeah.
And that's it. You've got 2 weeks to avoid essentially, you know, people posing as police officers. But these people had, you know, jobs in the military, special forces. And they're trained professionals. And you have to move a certain amount per day and blah, blah, blah. But it was absolutely full on.
Yeah, it was great fun. It was fun to watch, actually. You guys did really well. So look, here is my challenge for you. You've probably heard of it, but I can see you going for it. And my goodness, if you could rope Jamie into it as well, then that would be a hell of an adventure. He'll say no, I'm sure. And that's the Atlantic Challenge, rowing across the Atlantic.
I'd absolutely love to do that.
I bet you would.
And this is no disrespect to Jamie, but I might, you know, choose Matthew Pinton or something.
He's done it, I think. You know, you can do it alone. The real challenge is to do it solo. Plenty of people have got, you know, teams, or you can have boats of up to 8, I think. But there are a handful of people that have done it on their own.
I'd adore to do something like that. I've got the Ice Ultra coming up on the 22nd of February, which is 230 kilometres. Across Arctic Sweden, very similar to the Marathon des Sables, but it's minus 40 at times up there instead of plus 59. So, yeah, that's going to be a goodie. Looking forward to that. Actually, it is. I think I might even get to see the Northern Lights if I'm lucky. Mate, I would absolutely. Why don't we row the Atlantic? You hop in.
I mean, I could be there at the start and the finish.
I can tell you want to do it.
It's the three kids thing, though, Spencer. That's the trouble. You know, I'm just, I've got to be there for them. You know, and this is like 40, 50 days at sea. It's not like 6 days on the desert. You know, it's a proper, proper commitment.
No, absolutely. Well, mate, it's funny you mention it. Actually, I've always been attracted to the idea of doing it. So who knows? Let's see what the future holds. Maybe when the kids are a bit older.
Do you know what? If we revisit this in 10 years, when they don't need me around so much, I'd be there for it. But right now, too much of a lifestyle thing. But I would. I've witnessed people do it. I've made a film of people doing it before in one of my early jobs, and I was just in awe of them. More people have been to space than have rowed across the Atlantic. I mean, that's crazy.
Well, if we're talking about making a film, then I'm going to have to do it. You know, I wouldn't be able to not.
Yeah. All right, fine. We'll pencil it in for 10 years' time. Maybe 5 years.
Let's do it.
All right, you're on. Spencer, it's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed our chat. Thank you very much for your company today.
So have I, mate. And thanks so much for having me on your fine show. And speak soon.
Look forward to it. Take it easy. Have a great rest of your holiday. You can return to the Maldives, right?
Excellent. Yeah, I'm still here.
Get in the sea and have a lovely time.
Thanks so much, dude.
Brilliant.
Cheers,
take
mate. Have a lovely day.
All the best. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. The Andy J Podcast. Well, there we go. That I told you. What a nice guy. What a thoughtful, interesting chap. And as you probably heard, we interrupted his family holiday. He was speaking to me from a room in the Maldives. I mean, wow. That's commitment, isn't it? That's dedication to pushing your business and keeping the brand going. Taking an hour or so out of your amazing holiday to chat to someone on the other side of the world with a slightly different time zone. So good on him for that. And as I said earlier, we've subsequently met and he's as nice in real life as he is in interview mode. So very impressive guy. Now, I can tell you who's next on the Andy J Podcast. Really pleased to be able to say I will be spending an hour with the lovely, well, slightly more than an hour, I suspect, with the lovely Kate Humble. Now, Kate has lived an incredible life on and off our screens. On screen, she has been, you know, in the very early days, she presented Top Gear many moons ago, amongst many other things, before she got into the likes of the things we know her for now, which is Life on the Farm and Country File and so on, and Springwatch, etc. So I'm really looking forward to chatting to her. I think she's going to be absolutely fascinating. Next week on the Andy J podcast, Kate Humble. For now, thank you so much for your company today. It means the world. Go well, have a wonderful week, and we'll speak again next week. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
The Andy J podcast.